For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Proverbs 26, the fool and the sluggard. As you can tell, we were in Proverbs 3 last week. We're not going through this book verse by verse. You really can't teach the book of Proverbs verse by verse. It's not a linear book. It's kind of circular in the way it presents things. And it kind of jumps around. And so what we're looking to do is we're trying to find passages that do have a flow of thought, that do have kind of a context that we can teach through. We picked a few of those the last couple weeks and next week. And then we're also going to spend about 3 or 4 weeks taking a little more of a topical approach and exploring some main themes in Proverbs. But we're trying to give you a taste of this whole book. And so what we've got here this evening, these are, again, this is also another section titled The Proverbs of King Solomon, but these were compiled later by King Hezekiah, which would have been a couple hundred years after Solomon's death. And these poems, these describe two different fellows. The first one is the first 12 verses, and that describes a fellow known as the Kaseel, which is the most common term for a fool. It appears almost 50 times in the book of Proverbs. And 11 of those are in these 12 verses. So every verse except for one explicitly contains the verb kaseel. This is the strongest concentration of that word in the whole book. And if you remember, the book of Proverbs, it kind of presents things in generalities. And so it's got these different characters that recur throughout the book. One of them is the kaseel. It's a special kind of fool that we'll talk about. The other one, the final 4 verses of this section, is another guy known as the sluggard, a close cousin of the fool. He shows up about 13 times in this book. And there's a handful of other verses about where it talks about basically this guy, but doesn't use his name. Well, these 4 verses, each one of them has the word sluggard in it. And so we're going to try and see what we can learn about the kaseel and the sluggard. So first of all, the fool, the kaseel, starting in verse 1. It says, like snow in summer or rain in harvest, honor is not fitting for a fool. So like I said, we see this word fool, kaseel. The root word for this means thick. So you can imagine someone that's kind of thick-headed or, not very observant to what's going on around them. You know, the wise person, as we've seen, is the person who's very observant, who takes in life, who observes life, and lives wisely based on his observations. The fool is kind of oblivious, the kaseel. And it's not because of his IQ. This is a moral issue. It's a moral issue. He doesn't want to see. He basically wants to live life his way, and, you know, the things around him are more of an obstacle to getting what he wants. Basically, this person is a dumb ass. If you don't know what that is, I looked it up in the Urban Dictionary. And it says, dumb ass. Someone who looks up the word dumb ass in a dictionary. Uses it in a sentence, too. If you don't know what a dumb ass is, you're really a dumb ass. Slightly edited for general audience. The fool, the kaseel, has basically rejected all correction and is determined to satisfy his own lust. He's got these desires, he's got things that he wants, and he really doesn't care. You know, he's a rebellious figure. You know, if others stand in his way, he's going to find a way around to get what he wants. He's self-seeking. He can actually be pretty charismatic. He's not a stupid person. Actually, can be quite brilliant. Sometimes the most charismatic one of the bunch. And has developed the ability to use people, to con people, to trick people into thinking that he's harmless, that they should feel sorry for him, that they should give him his way, that they should go along with him, that he knows what he's talking about. A couple proverbs on this guy: doing wickedness is like sport to a fool, and so is wisdom to a man of understanding. He just enjoys doing wrong, just like a wise person actually enjoys wisdom, enjoys truth. We get excited about that. He gets excited about what he can do wrong. Talks about the contagious nature of these guys. Leave the presence of a fool or you will not discern words of knowledge. They can be confusing and they can have this effect on a whole group if they're allowed to run wild. A rebuke goes deeper into one who has understanding than 100 blows into a fool. There you see how thick this person really is. How resilient they are to, you know, just burning their, you know, they'll stick their hand in the fire 99 times and burn it every time and then they'll just go right back and do it again. And they'll feel sorry for themselves. Fools have no interest in understanding. They only want to air their own opinions. Again, they don't really care what reality is. They just want to speak what they think about things. They want to do what they want. And finally, it's senseless to pay tuition to educate a fool since he has no heart for learning. You can send him to the finest college around. You can send him to the finest boarding school, bring in the best tutors. This person will not learn. They don't want to learn. And you're wasting your money. The more money you pour into a KSEAL, really, the bigger mistake you're making. And that's really the point of this passage here. Notice how it says, honor is not fitting for a fool. Honor is not fitting for a fool. This poem, this whole 12-verse poem is really concerned with what is fitting or what is congruous or incongruous more often. This just, you know, this isn't fitting. This is incongruous. This shouldn't be. And he says, honor is not fitting for fools. Fools should not get honor. You know, the wise person, as we've learned, they understand how the world works. They understand how life works. They understand how they fit into life. They're not going against the grain of reality. On the other hand, the KSEAL, they have no idea how life works or how wisdom might apply to life. And so therefore, honor and power and influence just don't fit a fool. You know, I remember when graduated from college, okay, so I'm like 24 at this point, and I went to buy shoes, and I noticed my size 13s were not fitting me anymore, which is really frustrating, because if you like to shop at the discount shoe stores, you know that they don't really carry the 13s, because most people don't need size 13. You know, if they do have them, there'll be like this giant neon sticker on there that says 13, which is basically saying, hey, freak, this one might fit you. And I realize if I go 14, then I can't shop at those discount shoe stores anymore. I'm going to have to buy them online from lands where people have bigger feet. Or I have to pay three times as much. But, you know, as try as I might try, you know, I just, my feet grew a little bit more. And I just had to get on board and deal with it. And, you know, with a fool, there are certain things that just don't fit. And as try as hard as you might to get those to fit a fool, they just don't. It just doesn't fit right. And so honor and power and influence, that is the last thing that a fool needs. The last thing a fool needs is more recognition. You know, if you enlarge the destructive influence of a fool, you'll cause much other harm. You're basically arming the lunatics. You know, kind of like rain during a harvest. You know, he says snow in the summer is bad. It's not supposed to be there. But it actually can ruin that. There's a crop. One of their crops would sit all summer long, and then they would harvest it in September and October. But, you know, imagine this farmer who's worked hard all spring and all summer, and then only to have this freak snowstorm roll in and ruin their crop. And he's thinking to himself, if only I had the power to control the weather. And what God says is, and what Solomon recognizes, is no, you don't have the power to control the weather, but there is a much more destructive force you can control. And that is not to give a fool power and honor. So this is not just about the KSEAL, but it's also about how you, assuming you're not a fool, how to deal wisely with fools, i.e. what is fitting for fools. So, verse 2, he says, like a fluttering sparrow or a darting swallow, an undeserved curse does not come to rest. All right, what is he talking about there, an undeserved curse? You know, before we think Harry Potter, you know, this is really the speech of a fool. You know, you might set up a boundary with a fool. You might tell him no. You might even, you know, if you're employing one, you might say you don't work here anymore. And they might shake their fists and say, you'll pay and you'll regret this. And, you know, this is a big mistake you're making. And what he's saying here is the speech of a fool can be pretty safely ignored. They might tell you that bad is going to come your way, but they don't know how things work. And they probably have some sort of an underlying motive for self anyway. And so don't worry about it. Don't allow yourself to be manipulated. Here's another one. A whip for the horse, a halter for the donkey, and a rod for the backs of fools. Whoa. Well, those are pretty dumb beasts, the horse, the donkey, and they need structures on them to control them. You know, the rod for the backs of fools, this is basically their form of discipline back then. They didn't have prisons. They had the rod. And what he's saying is, you know, what the fool doesn't need. Some people think the fool just needs a chance. No, actually, here's what he says is the fool actually needs some discipline. The fool needs somebody to take a stand with them and not let them rampage all over their own life and all over other people's lives. Maybe they'll learn something. We set up a boundary with a fool if we discipline a fool. Obviously, he's not literally recommending that you and I use a rod. But there are ways we can discipline with our words and also by, you know, setting up boundaries. And so maybe they'll learn something. You know, that's what the person needs. And maybe nobody has ever loved them enough to discipline them, to say no. There might actually be some hope for them. It also is going to minimize their influence. You know, a fool, if left to himself, you know, these can be, the case seal can be pretty charismatic, pretty strong, and they can actually exert influence over a whole group of people. A group or a family who won't discipline the fool is headed for disaster. You know, this, think about your own family. This might be part of the problem, is there's like a fool or two that are ruining Christmas for the rest of us. You know, everybody is just, it's like they're held hostage. They're in bondage to this case seal. And everybody talks about them, and everybody complains about them, but nobody will say anything. Nobody cares enough to speak into this person's life. You'll see this in Christian groups as well. One or two of these types of figures, if they're not recognized and if a stand is not taken with them, you know, they're putting these people up to teach, they're letting these people, you know, in some cases they might even, you know, we've got these Christian living houses, in some cases they might need to be removed from a ministry house. But, you know, they just kind of let them do whatever they want in the group, and all of a sudden they've got all this influence, and it can wreck a group, you know, like a snow right at the end of a great harvest. It can ruin the whole thing. He also says, you know, we read this one last week, don't answer a fool according to his folly or you'll be like him yourself. And then answer a fool according to his folly or he'll be wise in his own eyes. You know, these are two things you got to weigh out here. These are contrasting proverbs. And the fool hasn't, you know, the fool doesn't really know how different proverbs fit in different situations. Most wisdom is that way. It fits in this situation and, you know, this one might fit a little better over here. And it's a nuanced consideration that needs to be taking place in our minds. The fool has no idea which one to use. They'll pick the wrong one pretty much every time. They don't know, but you should. You know, a lot of proverbs actually are contrasting proverbs. You know, think about some in our day. A penny saved is a penny earned. You know, the value of saving, and saving's a really hard thing, and you should look to do that. And if you've saved a penny, well, gosh darn it, then you've earned that penny twice. But on the other hand, we've got penny wise and pound foolish. And that's a person that is always, you know, trying to look for the best deal, but ends up buying a piece of junk. You know, to save a few pennies, they've ended up buying, you know, a car that sucks. Or, you know, they're scrimping and saving. Sometimes you got to spend money, too. The fool has no idea when those apply and basically will just apply the one that he or she wants, the one that he or she wants to do. Trusting a fool to convey a message is like cutting off one's feet or drinking poison. Back in the day before the phone or email or even the Pony Express, so we're talking way back in the day, if you wanted to communicate a message to somebody in another city, you know, you either got to take it yourself, which could take weeks or even months, depending on where that is, or you could keep working here and you can think, I'm going to save some time. I'm going to send this person to communicate a message for me. Well, it might seem like that's going to be a good idea. But that actually can be useless or even harmful. The message may never get to where you want to send it, or may get there in such a distorted form that it was pointless to send that. Communication's hard enough. Especially, you know, when you're trying to do it through a fool, it can become totally unintelligible. And then it looks like a message from you, and really that's not what you meant to communicate at all. This is why God can't use fools, by the way. Because God has a message he wants to communicate to this world. And if you're not trustworthy, if you're just going on your own impulses, then God says, you know what? I'll find somebody else that can carry this message for me. Of course, a proverb in the mouth of a fool is as useless as a paralyzed leg. Kind of gruesome here. You know, it looks like that leg would be useful, but in fact, it's not. I mean, it's just kind of there. In fact, he goes even further. He says it could actually be potentially dangerous. Two verses later, a proverb in the mouth of a fool is like a thorny branch brandished by a drunk. So you can imagine this drunk person, they put down a 12-pack, and then they go out and they break off this branch that's covered with thorns. I mean, it's like the drunk guy has a gun. That's what a proverb in the mouth of, I mean, okay, it's powerful, yeah. It could be used for something positive, and yet in his hands, you better watch out. You know, you got a drunk guy on the rampage. And most false teachers are basically proverbs in the mouth of a fool. They've got a verse or two from the Bible that they quote over and over again, and yet they're using it so out of context and so wrongly that they're actually doing serious damage to people's spiritual lives. You think about the passage we were studying last week, twisted by many into telling them what God's will for your life is that you're healthy all the time and that you're wealthy every moment here on this earth. And if you're not, then maybe you've got some kind of sin in your life. Oh, and by the way, you better send me some money so that God will bless your wealth and your health. And that might be your problem too. Just selfishly used by fools to maximize themselves and damage other people. Or think about this one. The fool might say, you know, what you really need to do in this situation is you need to follow your heart. Been watching a lot of Disney movies. The wise says, he who trusts in his own heart is a fool, but he who walks wisely will be delivered. The wise person says, I can't imagine where my life would be if I followed the impulses of my heart. My heart is deceitful, is what Scripture says. And the fool might, you know, just launch off following his heart. I mean, that's the story of his life. Follow your heart. The wise person says, fear the Lord and follow him and act wisely, taking into account the way the world really is. You can't just think, well, I'm a Christian, so if I just follow my heart, then my life is going to be awesome. No! It's a good way to ruin your life. And that's the way a fool talks, and that's the way a fool acts. Honoring a fool is as foolish as tying a stone to a slingshot. So, you know, this works with our concept of slingshot as well. But, you know, their slingshot, it was like a pouch where you put the rock, and then there was two kind of straps coming off of each side. And so they would swing it around, and they'd get going real fast, and then they'd release one of the straps, and so the stone would then be free to leave the pouch. Now, imagine if you tied that thing into the slingshot. You know, you're spinning around and around and around and around, and then you release one of them, thinking the stone's going to go flying. Instead, it just gets a little bit longer and comes right around and whacks you right in the face. And that's what he says, honoring a fool, you're basically taking all that power of centripetal force in the slingshot, and it could come right back and drill him in the face. It's improper, it's unable to do any good, and he'll probably hurt himself. You know, the fool, what he needs is not more honor and glory and encouragement. You know, otherwise you're just going to puff him up even more. He's going to think he's even more right. He's going to be even less willing to listen to other people, and he's going to end up injuring himself even worse. An employer who hires a fool or a bystander is like an archer who shoots at random. So what's the point here? If you hire a fool, you become responsible for his actions and you magnify his influence. You know, it's like, you know, you're the employer. You've taken the arrow, you've loaded it into the bow, you've released it, you've launched the fool out on his job, but basically you don't know where that's going to land, and here you are stuck holding the bow. You know, you might as well, he says, just fire arrows straight up into the air. Just randomly fire arrows, and then, you know, you don't know where they're going to go, but you're responsible for the outcome. It's a good way to ruin your business, hiring a fool, and harm a lot of other people and trash your own reputation in the process. Verse 11, vivid, as a dog returns to its vomit, so a fool repeats his foolishness. So the dog... You know, I don't know if you've ever seen a dog do this, but as soon as, at least my dog is this way. At least he was this morning. vomiting several times, and then it's like you got to hold him back to keep him from going and lapping that stuff right back up. You know, the fool can't grasp that there's a reason why he puked that up. You know, and so there, it's lying there, this pile of vomit, and then he starts thinking to himself, man, what is that, Burger King over there? He's looking around, he's like, nobody's going to eat that? And he just plunges right back in and laps it right back up. He's unable to learn from his mistakes. That's what the fool is. He can't learn from the things that he does wrong. The wise person isn't going to make as many mistakes, but when they do, they are sure going to learn from those. You know, if you can just make each mistake in your life only once, you're going to be doing pretty well for yourself. He's unable to learn from his mistakes. And so don't think that hiring the fool or giving him a role is going to change him. You know, it's like you see, again, take the families. You see families where you've got this one fool and the parents keep jumping in with thousands of dollars at a time to bail him out of the latest mess that he's in. And they just think, oh, he's just had it so rough, and oh, he just needs a little break, and we just need to help him out. All you're doing is making a fool rich for a little while. You're giving him the power to do something else really stupid. And then he's going to be poor again, and he's going to come crying, and he's going to wonder, why isn't somebody going to bail me out? He gets mad at people. Well, there's more hope for fools than for people who think they are wise. This is a good warning corrective to conclude this poem. On the one hand, we need to be able to recognize the fool, to not maximize the damage that the fool can do. But on the other hand, we must not become smug or self-righteous either. We're not patting ourselves on the back or admiring ourselves for not being a fool. We need to have the humility to understand that, you know, that there's not that much difference between me and this person. You know, I could have been there and I could still go there. You know, if it weren't for a few, maybe even a few key decisions in my life or a few key events that happened to me. And so we don't want to get smug or self-righteous. We don't want to think I'm so wise. Because if we do, then that's really the first step on the path to becoming a fool. So that's the fool. And, you know, the theme that's come out here, you know, yes, recognizing the fool, but really learning how to interact with the fool. And not maximizing the influence that the fool has. Which brings us to verse 13, our other character, a guy known as the sluggard. And I'm sure you might be able to guess what the sluggard is like. The sluggard is a lazy person who lives a directionless life. You know, it's not exactly equivalent to a fool, but a sluggard is a fool. But they could kind of be viewed as like the fool's cousin here in Proverbs. It's a special character that gets singled out. A character that many of us, may know some sluggards. The sluggard is more intent on cultivating personal comfort and avoiding exertion than on accomplishing anything in his life. That is his goal. He actually is driven in a way. He's driven to maximize peace for himself or herself. He's driven to get as much comfort as possible, and he's actually got some pretty sophisticated techniques that he uses in order to get those. But first, before we talk more about the sluggard, I do want to think about the theology that lies behind Solomon's observations. You know, wisdom literature, it's kind of a scientific way of observing the world. It's trial and error, it's observing, it's testing, it's paying attention. And, you know, these results that the sage observes, the reason they observe those results is because there's some sort of an underlying principle. There's really a way that God is or a way that we are that brings about such a predictable result in our lives. And so I wanted to think about this. I want to give you four theological points here. One is an important characteristic of God is that God pursues concrete goals. God is not a God that's just aimless. He's not a God that just does nothing in particular for no good reason, but he actually does everything for a reason and pursues a goal. And Jesus was the same way. You know, when Jesus was on earth, he says, "Behold, I cast out demons, and I perform cures today and tomorrow, and on the third day, I reach my goal." Jesus, the reason he left heaven was to accomplish a purpose. And the whole time throughout his ministry here on earth, he knew where this was headed. He says in John chapter 12, he says, "And now the hour has come, and my soul is troubled deeply." But he says, "What am I supposed to say? Father, save me from this hour? No way! This is the whole reason I came." A few days before the cross. He also says, "My Father is working until now, and I myself am working." And so it's not just the work Jesus did while he was here on earth, but that was really the culmination of a plan that lasted several thousand years. Really, since before the beginning of time, God knew what was going to happen. He had things in place. He knew about the sin that human beings would bring into the world, the reason we even have fools in the first place. The reason why we have evil in the first place. And he knew that human beings would play a major role in bringing that in. We weren't the first. There was an angelic rebellion before ours, but humans brought this upon ourselves. And God knew that something needed to be done about that. That he couldn't just allow evil to go unpunished. And so he crafted this plan to send Jesus to earth. For Jesus to live a perfect life. For Jesus to die for sins. And for Jesus to offer that forgiveness to anybody who wants it. And so that's why Jesus came. And What we read too in scriptures that God made humans in his image, including goal attainment. He's not the only one that had a goal that he sought to attain. He's included humans in this plan. A lot of people think that work, having to work at all, is a product of sin, and that we live in this fallen world, and that's why we have to do work. Not so. Genesis chapter 2, the Lord God took the man and he put him into the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and to keep it. God had man working long before sin ever entered the picture. He said, look, here's something to do. We're made to do something, to have some sort of direction, some sort of output. You know, and Jesus, when he left earth after his death and resurrection, he said, as the Father is sending me, so I send you. He sent us out with a mission as well to tell people of this forgiveness, to offer this, to tell people that God's offering it to anyone who wants to receive it. Well, we learn also in the Bible that autonomous goals offend God. He doesn't just want us to make up goals and go for them. It's not just goals that I decide to pursue. It's actually the goals that God wants us to pursue in accordance, in uniformity with his direction for our lives. Proverbs 3, we studied last week. He says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he'll make your path straight. God says, I want to set the course for your life. And I need to, and I deserve to, and I should. Or James 4, where God is talking to these people in the churches James was writing to, and he's like, you guys are saying, you know, I'm going to do business here, and then I'm going to move over there next year and do some business there, and they've got their whole lives planned out. And God says, who are you, O dew of the morning? There at 6 a.m., gone by 9 a.m. when the sun comes out. You're like a breath, like a puff of wind. You're so temporary. You need to consider me and what I want for your life. And maybe you need to make goals in accordance with my will. God's pretty upset about that, actually. And we read in Scripture that refusal to set and pursue concrete goals is sinful. You know, I think these first three points people might not be opposed to, but I think this fourth one, some of us might not agree with that. And I don't have time to fully argue this case. One passage is one we studied last spring in Matthew 25. You can download that from our website or my podcast, where Jesus tells this story about this guy who God leaves him with some money and says, you know, I want you to put this to good work. Gave him some talents, and he went away on a journey. And when he got back, the guy hadn't done anything. And the master says, you wicked and lazy servant. You know, he hadn't done anything wrong with the money. He just hadn't done anything with it. And so, God's upset when we don't set and pursue concrete goals. That's sinful. And it's not just Matthew 25. It's also the teaching on the sluggard in the Proverbs is one of the main bodies of biblical evidence on this, biblical teaching on this. And so we want to take a look at what we learn about the sluggard here in this passage, and also we'll incorporate some insights from the other sluggard passages. We're going to see three things about the sluggard here this evening. First of all, one problem with sluggards is they just can't get started. They're master procrastinators. He says, in verse 13, the sluggard says, there's a lion in the road. A fierce lion is roaming the streets. Okay, that's kind of weird. What is he talking about? He brings it, what is this, Zanesville? He brings it up again. He says, the sluggard says, just a few chapters, there's a lion outside. I'll be killed in the streets. What does this have to do with a lazy person? Well, I don't know if you've ever had this experience where you get home from work at the end of a long day. You come in. Your roommate is sitting there on the same couch that he was sleeping on when you left for work that morning, having breakfast. Doesn't even pause his video game when you walk in, and you're like, hey, so how's that job search going? And he's like, oh, dude, I would have gotten right on it today, but I heard there's a lion in the streets. And you don't want me to put myself at risk, do you? You see, the sluggard is a master of making excuses. You know, back then, actually, I think occasionally maybe a lion could wander into a town. But the sluggard is looking for any reason at all to just, you know, he's well-intentioned. He's going to do it. But tomorrow, you know, there's some good reason why today it's just not going to work for me. I'm just gonna get on that first thing tomorrow morning. The way of the sluggard is blocked with thorns, but the path of the upright is a highway. You know, something always stands in the way of the sluggard. You know, their roads, they just always seem to be overgrown. They just can't get through. And if they do make their way through, it's just slow, painful hacking through the thorns that have just grown over the path. On the other hand, some people, the diligent, the upright, they never seem to be waylaid or delayed like the sluggard seems to be. Proverbs 6 is a classic passage on the sluggard. He says, "Why don't you go to the ant, O sluggard? Observe her ways and be wise." Wisdom's always a girl in Proverbs. "Which, having no chief, officer, or ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provision in the harvest." You know, the ant is not the smartest creature in the world. Really strong. But always seems to be carrying something around. They always seem to have a little leaf they're carrying back to their little anthill, a little piece of hamburger bun, 400 times their weight or whatever. And, you know, when winter comes around, they got a nice big pile of leaves and hamburger buns deep in the earth for them to munch on. They know right where they are. On the other hand, the sluggard's not that way. He says, "How long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep?" You start asking a sluggard these kinds of questions. At what point are you going to go ahead and get started here? Summer is quickly fading here. Autumn is coming, and then the winter. What are you going to do? And the sluggard gives the classic sluggard answer. "Well, just a little more sleep. A little slumber. A little folding of the hands to rest." The sluggard's like, "I just need to hit the snooze one more time. I just need a little bit more time. I'm conserving my strength. I'm building up my energy. I'm resting. And I am, boy, I'm going to get on that first thing tomorrow afternoon." And he says, "Your poverty will come in like a vagabond and your need like an armed man." You know, it's going to feel pretty sudden to the sluggard. It's not really going to surprise anybody else. But the sluggard is going to feel like out of nowhere they just got hit by a bus. You know, when they finally eat their last piece of bread, when they finally blow through the last of their bank account, when the person who they've been mooching off of finally says, "Look, you can't mooch off of me anymore." Then all of a sudden, their world is going to come collapsing down around them in despair at the thought that, what am I going to do? Am I going to have to work? It's terrifying to the sluggard, and they're not ready for it. And this really brings us to the next problem with the sluggard, verse 14. "As a door turns on its hinges, so a sluggard turns on his bed." The sluggard just loves to sleep. And that really gets in the way of him starting anything. You know, the door turning on its hinges, you know, it's like, you can imagine, you're watching the sluggard, they're in bed, and it looks like they're stirring, it looks like they're actually going to get up. But then all of a sudden, it's like the door just swings back shut again. They were just turning over. Because, you know, it's 11 a.m., and sleep at 11 a.m. is usually not that good. They just love to sleep. They can't get out of bed in the morning. Proverbs 20, "Do not love sleep or you'll grow poor. Stay awake and you'll have food to spare." This is a tough one for me. I have a hard time getting out of bed. I love to hit that snooze alarm. I love my warm bed. I got an electric blanket and flannel sheets. And that bedroom just feels so cold in the morning. You know, it's like in my alarm clock. I've had it since first grade. And the FM functionality broke in like fourth grade. So I've just spent like hours just lying there listening to AM radio in the morning. The sluggard thinks he's just resting until he feels like working. You know, it's just like, one more snooze. I just need a little more rest. In reality, though, what he doesn't realize is that it's his sloth that's what's holding him captive. It's his very refusal to work that makes him feel more and more worn out. Proverbs 13, "The soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing." You can see the life of misery, of unhappiness that the sluggard lives. The desire of the diligent will be abundantly satisfied. It's actually the hard worker that seems to be happy. That seems to have a lot more energy than the sluggard who sleeps all the time. Proverbs 21, "The desire of the sluggard puts him to death, for his hands refuse to work. All day long he's craving, while the righteous gives and does not hold back." And so the sluggard just spends all day doing nothing and craving. And that's because the sluggard looks to something that can never satisfy. They feel worn out and they look to rest. They look to sleep. They look to satisfying my whims and my desires. And the reality is, that's just going to make you more and more empty. You know, this is true. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but you know, for me, if I've got something I need done, like in our home church, for example, and I can't do it myself, you know who I go to get it done? It's usually not the person that's doing the least. It's usually the person that's doing the most. They're usually the ones raising their hand. They're usually the ones volunteering, while the slugger's kind of sitting in back, hoping somebody else will step forward for this duty that needs to be done. And that's because the diligent person actually gets energy because they're living in accordance with the way they were designed. They're not fighting against the very image of God that was built into them. But they're going with it. They're imitating God. And they're living the way they were meant to live and the way the world is designed. You know, this craving, deep in the heart of the sluggard, this unhappiness, this becomes fertile ground for secret sin. So often the case, the sluggard is not just a lazy person, but they've got a porno habit going on the side. They've got an eating habit. They've got a spending habit. They've got a secret sex affair going on the side, a relationship that nobody else knows about. And that's because in the vacuum of work, in the vacuum of purpose, in the vacuum of direction, something's got to come in. And that's where sin comes in. Sluggards just can't get started. There's too many excuses, too many setbacks. It's too cold. I'm too tired. There's a freaking lion in the street. And I just can't get to that. However, occasionally, the sluggard, when they do start something, they can't finish it. Verse 15, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish. But he's too lazy to bring it back to his mouth. You know, his hand is right there in the big dish full of candy corn. And he just passes out with one hand in the bowl. It's just too much. You know, the Herculean effort of starting something just proves to be too much for the sluggard. And so they just call it off. They call the game and they go back home. Because I just don't want to see this thing through. Proverbs 12:27, lazy people don't even cook the game they catch, but the diligent make use of everything they find. You know, it's like they've gone to the trouble of the hunt, and yet they get back and they're just like so exhausted that the thing spoils. They don't even get to eat it. They don't even get to enjoy their labor. This can be pretty demoralizing for the sluggard because they do make a little half-hearted attempt and then it fails and they just feel like I'm just destined to be this way for the rest of my life. They haven't seen it through. They're like, okay, so you're saying that it's fulfilling to work, and they kind of take a little poke at it, and then it doesn't work out, and they're like, see, it's not. And they go back to their life on the couch. It's especially frustrating for those who try to employ the sluggard. Proverbs 10:26 says, like vinegar to the teeth and smoke in the eyes, so is the lazy one to those who send him. I don't know what vinegar is like on your teeth. But smoke in the eyes, that hurts. You just want to look away. It's painful. And if you put a sluggard into your employment, if you send them to work, you know, I used to be a project manager, and I had some people I'd oversee that were really lazy. And I remember I would check in with them after a morning worth of work, and I'd be like, so what'd you get done? And I'd just be looking. I'm like, did you get anything done? And I was so mad I had to have them on my budget for that project. But that's the way a sluggard is. They just can't seem to get anything done. They're better at pretending to be busy than they are at actually doing any work, which is why they're usually not employed very long. That's one thing about the sluggard, and this poverty is going to catch up with them. Work very hard and become a leader. Be lazy and become a slave. Eventually, you're going to have to work. But the question is, are you going to do it as somebody that's massively in debt and that's really missed a lot of opportunities and ruined your life? Or are you going to do it proactively and on the right terms? Well, third and finally, sluggards, they can't get started, they can't finish what they start, and they just plain can't face reality. That's his final point here. He says, the sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who answer discreetly. Discreetly meaning accurately, appropriately. You know, the sluggard, they really have convinced themselves that everything's fine. They've rationalized the entire thing. The sluggard is often the last to know. It's almost like a gas is filling the room and they're slowly drifting off to sleep. And, you know, somebody looking in from the outside can tell, but they can't. They're just slipping off into a peaceful slumber, oblivion. Other people might try to tell them otherwise, but they won't hear any of it because they know. They understand. They know what they're really like. They're trying their best. They're just a victim. This is just the way they're wired. They just need extra sleep. They just had a lot of bad breaks go their way. They're just not that kind of person. Whatever the excuse is, rejecting all wisdom. And that's what this guy describes in Proverbs 24. He says, I went past the field of a sluggard, past the vineyard of someone who had no sense. Somehow this sluggard had managed to acquire some property. Maybe he had a hardworking family that left it to him. And he says, thorns had come up everywhere. The ground was covered with weeds and the stone wall was in ruins. He's just like, this is a tragedy that this vineyard is so overgrown and unkept. And he says, I applied my heart to what I observed and I learned a lesson from what I saw. You know, the sluggard probably feels like, you know, I could probably do a little weeding. There's probably a few things I need to get to. But they can't look at reality. They can't face the fact that they have a problem. And, you know, this is so bad that we read in the New Testament that it might even require intervention. You know, this is a sin that is serious enough that it's lumped in with other really bad sins, like, you know, murder. You know, where you might come to a person and say, look, you murder too much and you can't be part of this group anymore. Adultery, you know, you're living a sexually immoral lifestyle, and this has got to stop, or we're going to have to set up a boundary here and put you out of this community until you change your mind. He says that sluggardliness is the same way. Some lazy people are kind of surprised to hear that. They feel like it's not that bad. Yeah, it is that bad. Destructive to you, destructive to everybody else, because you're taking from everybody else, you're mooching, and so deceptive that it sometimes rises to this level. And they had a problem with this. A couple times in the New Testament they bring this up. And so, you know, some of you here tonight, you need to stop making excuses. You need to face reality that you have a problem with this. You need to spare yourself the future consequences. If you've got a family, you need to spare them the agony that they're going through. You need to spare the people in your home church the pain that you're putting them through, and also the emotional output it would require to sit you down like this. You need to read the signs here. You need to get some help. You need to try to overcome your sluggardliness. And that's what I want to talk about in the last little bit of time we've got here, overcoming this. Number one, I got 3 points here. Number one, you need to reflect on the difference between God's design for you and the reality of your life. You know, that's what the Proverbs is all about. It's not about just, you know, whipping yourself into shape. You know, he never told the sluggard to do anything except look at the ant. He tells the sluggard to look, but that's about it. Are you willing to observe reality? Are you willing to think about the truth, the way God is, and the way God has designed you? You know, this is something that is part of your very being. There's something inside of you that wants to be this way, and you know it. And if you're a Christian and have the Holy Spirit living inside of you, then you have even more hope and even more power at your disposal. If you're not, then you need to first come into the fear of the Lord, like we talked about a couple weeks ago. You need to come into a relationship with God. You need to become a Christian and receive the power that He has to change. But once you have that, you need to think about what you were designed for, the way God is, God's will for your life, and how different the joy that God promises is from the emptiness and unhappiness in your life. You need to let that sink in and think about that. You need to observe, is it really that fulfilling? This life of laziness, this life of sloth. Think about that. And it's not. Think about the people you know that are hard workers. They seem to be really happy. It's not because they're special. It's not because they have a different Holy Spirit than you. It's just because they're living their life in accordance with wisdom. And we can't just think that I'm a Christian and God's just going to give me this awesome life. No, you also need to listen to Him. To follow Him, to acknowledge Him in all your ways, like we talked about last week. Number two, you need to set some goals. You know, that was what kept Christ moving forward in those verses that I cited to you. We see God setting goals, and this is just, you know, when you set goals, You'll get vision. You'll start to get some hope. You'll see the kind of thing that you can do or the kind of person you can become. Motivation is going to increase because you're going to have something to set your sights on. You know, athletes are this way. You know, they've got a certain event they're training for. You know, the Olympics or whatever. They've got this goal and they've got the whole thing mapped out along the way. They've got incremental steps. You know, excitement is going to increase as you see yourself start to meet the small goals that you set. You feel like, wow, I can actually do something. You'll know when you've succeeded. A lot of times change is so slow, especially in this area, that you don't even realize anything good has happened. And I'm constantly amazed at how quick people are to discount any progress they have made and just to feel like this will never change and to sink back into despair. You're also going to know when you failed, which I think is part of the reason some people don't like to set goals is because they can't cope with that failure. Well, you're just going to need to get under grace. You know, the fact that you set a goal and didn't make it, you still probably got further than if you hadn't set any goal at all. So you need to set some goals. You know, types of goals that people often set. You got financial goals. I want to retire at age X, you know. Career goals. I've got this major that I'm pursuing and this internship I want to get. Fitness goals, you know, where I want to be able to bench X number of pounds or run a 5-minute mile or, you know, just fit into my clothes. There's also relational and spiritual goals. What's interesting is that with financial and career and fitness goals, these are not eternal things. These are things that are going to go away at the end of our life here on earth. And yet these are the ones that people usually set. On the other hand, these goals, these are eternal. And yet people rarely go about setting these things. They got their career path, they got their financial plan, they got their gym regimen. And yet you're like, so what are your relational and spiritual goals? And they're like, what are you talking about? No. You know, you think about a relational goal, where you can't go vague like, I just want to love people more. That's a worthless goal. You can't tell if you succeeded or failed, for one. Maybe you could say, I want to build a relationship with this person, and I'm going to block out time in my schedule every week to spend with that person. You know, that would be a pretty good relational goal. I'm going to build a relationship, even when it doesn't feel good. I'm going to work on my relational life. What about a spiritual goal? Where you're like, and I remember from a pretty early stage thinking, you know what? I want to teach the Bible someday. And so, you know, I kind of, in my head, began mapping out, well, I'm going to have to learn the Bible. I have to learn how to love people. Just so they can, you know, listen, you know, just so they'll want to listen to what I have to say and so I'll have something good to say. You know, Paul says in 1 Timothy 3, if you desire to be an elder, that's a really good goal. I remember having that goal really as a relatively young Christian. And I remember even, I was hanging out with this girl and I told her, I was like, you know what, I want to be an elder someday. And she kind of looked at me like real weird and I was like, yeah, I guess that's kind of arrogant, isn't it? She's like, yeah. But no. It's not actually. That's a good, even if, you know, other things would need to fall in place for that to happen, like God's calling for your life. But, you know, to pursue the level of character and the level of ministry that would be required for that to be possible, I think that's a really good goal. So relational and spiritual goals, maybe you should consider setting some of those. And maybe not as many of the above kind. Of course, if you don't set any goals at all, I think the above ones are good as well. But make sure you consider the bottom two in addition to the top three. Set some goals. And third and finally, seek outside help. Help outside of yourself. For one, accountability. Talking to other people. Maybe you can take a class with somebody. You don't have to do it all yourself. If you're wondering, how can I stretch myself, you know, with mentally, my knowledge of the Bible, maybe just take a class with somebody else that's going to stretch you in that direction. You know, telling people about what you're trying to do. Sometimes that alone is enough to give you the power to follow through on it. Also, productivity tools can be helpful for some people. Keeping like a planner, I use Google Calendar, as well as a little notepad I just leave on my desktop, and I kind of jot things down in both of those. And you know, it's a pretty loose system. I've taken all the Franklin Covey training and all the productivity training and stuff like that, and that all feels pretty restrictive for me, but you know, just having something where you can kind of keep track of what you're doing and what you're trying to do, that could be helpful for some of us. Writing out our goals and considering, what am I going to need to do? How am I going to fit these into my schedule to accomplish these? And finally, I think some reading can be pretty helpful on this as well. I've got a paper by Gary DeLashmit that's on how to combat the besetting sins of someone that's kind of a phlegmatic temperament, which often fits the profile of this right here. I can send that out tomorrow if somebody reminds me. It used to be on our website, but I couldn't find it up there. Watchman Nee, though, has a great book with a chapter on this very thing right here. And I just wanted to conclude. His book is called Normal Christian Worker. And I just wanted to conclude with a little bit of a longer quote from this. Nee says, "There are some young people who from the outset of their Christian life manifest qualities that give you confidence in expecting something to develop, expecting them to develop into useful servants of Christ. And on the other hand, there are those who, though not lacking in gift, before long fall by the way and bring dishonor on his name. This person may have a real desire to serve the Lord, but he lacks the disposition of a true servant. And one of these qualities that you must have to serve God is diligence. It seems superfluous to say, since we're talking about Christian workers, but it is in fact essential to say with emphasis that a Christian worker must be a person who has a will to work. Sloth is not an uncommon failing. Slothful people never seek work. If work comes their way, they seek to evade it. Alas, many Christians as well as non-Christians suffer from this complaint, and they are a drag on their associates. Have you ever known an effective Christian worker who is indolent? No. They are all diligent and always on the alert lest they squander time or strength." Think about that. How many good Christian workers do you know that are lazy? I can't think of any. You know, usually the best Christian workers are also the ones that are succeeding in other parts of their lives as well. He says they're not always looking for an opportunity to rest, but rather seek to buy up every opportunity to serve the Lord. They're constantly on the alert. I get worn out sometimes talking to certain people, just being around them and looking at the way they think about serving the Lord. You know, I feel the conviction that I'm not like you. Alas, many professed Christian workers do not trouble to go out in search of opportunities to serve the Lord. So they're not out they're not seeking opportunities to serve God. And if someone comes up to them unsought, they look upon this as an interruption instead of as an opportunity, and they only hope the person will depart and cease to bother them. What do you call this? It's called sloth. Some so-called full-time Christian workers are so super spiritual that they see no need to work hard or to account to anyone for their work. If they were employed in an ordinary job, no earthly master would let them off with such slackness as characterized their work. You'd be fired if you were turning out this same effort down at Wendy's. And you expect to serve the Lord this way? They actually delude themselves into thinking they can serve God like that. And diligence, he says, is primarily an inward matter. It's not measured by outward busyness. It's not a function of how many things are on a to-do list. It's really a matter of the heart. A heart that's diligent, that's zealous for serving the Lord. And he says, if by divine enabling we do this, a transformation will take place in our characters. I like that. It's not if I muster up my willpower, but it's as if by the power of God, he changes me into this kind of a person. We shall cease to be loafers and shall become those who welcome hard work and are glad to be servants of the Lord. Oh, that we might awaken to the urgency of the need around us, the fleeting nature of time. Our time is almost gone. The need is still desperate. Our solemn obligation is undischarged. There's work to do, a rescue mission that God has sent you on. And there's still time. There's still work left to do on that. And he says, let us as dying men give ourselves with all our powers to the dying around us. We dare not let general sloth trick us into procrastination, but this very day we must arise and bid our bodies to serve us. The work is too important. There's too much to be done. There's too much opportunity here. We've got to make the most of our time, redeeming every opportunity. Why don't we just take a few minutes to pray? Yeah, Lord, I pray you'd save us from the fate of the fool and the sluggard. Thank you, Lord, too, that you're not asking us to whip ourselves into shape, but you're asking for us to be humble enough to listen to you and humble enough to observe the way that life is. And Lord, that you want us to live the best life possible. And you also want us to have the best eternal life possible. And so I pray that we would not be discouraged or disheartened by what we've read here this evening, but that, you know, Lord, that we'd be convicted if we need to be, and that we would also see the hope that you offer and the kind of vision for the kind of life that you want us to live. Lord, we pray too that for anybody here who has not receive the gift of forgiveness that you set out to do. You set a goal and you accomplished that, Lord. I pray if anybody has not received that forgiveness, that they would consider doing so right here this evening. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.